accession number 28698, Reel 9.
Major Lawton, Reel 9. So your first experience was pretty much a learning curve.
Oh, for the British Army it was.
And at this point in time, the intensity, the murdering, and that wasn't quite as bad as it became, and you weren't being, other than what you've mentioned with the Protestants, you weren't being fired at and killed off the way ultimately things turned out.
No, certainly not by the IRA or the Catholic side. It was very much, the first two were very much the Protestants being the aggressor.
Were you able to form an opinion of the B specials in the bit time that you knew them and were involved with them?
Well, we were certainly glad they were there, because one, they knew the streets, and two, they knew the people. And they were excellent guides, and we got some sleep at night while they looked after us. But yes, we did witness things where they took a harsh line again on Catholics, and they would kick them and they would punch them, and there was no fairness, I suppose, in some cases. Not all of them, but the odd case, yes, they could be brutal.
They were Protestants, anyway.
Yeah. I think they were still called the Black and Tans by the Catholic population. But they had the streets under control up until that point.
And was there any level that you could actually make a relationship with the people? You've mentioned the fact that you hearts and minds. You were able to get that level of relationship, were you?
With the Catholic people, we could, because they knew if we weren't there, they would all be burnt out and they'd all be murdered. And we were literally there dragging them out of the houses, dragging their furniture out of the houses, getting them out of the houses to places of safety. We were the buffer line between them and the Protestants.
Do you recall any incident yourself when you were personally involved in something of that nature?
Well, it happened virtually all the time. I mean, we would go from area to area. I mean, there'd be 8 of us walking down the street, then you see a crowd of several hundred at the bottom, you think, oh dear. But our presence there would stop them coming any further up the street. So we could contain them from not coming any further up the street.
And in your weapons, were you carrying live ammunition?
Oh yes. But we're still using the same silly little A-40s and A-41 radios. And them, in a built-up area, like the streets and tenements of Belfast, were about as much good as having a box of cornflakes on your back. And I've seen soldiers hiding behind the radios as the bullets and the bricks would come. But radios, for being radios, were not much good at all.
Were you given instructions, if you had to fire your weapons, to fire above the crowd's heads as a first?
No, we never thought. If you've got to use your weapon, it's got to be to protect life, yours, or that of your comrades or the police. Not necessarily for property, but to protect life of your own. And if you're going to kill, that means you must be in a position where they're going to kill you, or you've got to kill them first. There's never warning shots.
Might be a difficult question, but what was the opinion you not just you personally, but your soldiers were formed about the two sides, the Catholics? Did you feel that one was...
I don't think we had any opinions at the time. I know for a fact there's quite a few soldiers later, in a year later or so, married girls from both persuasions, but certainly married some of the Catholic population. That was for sure.
So there must, at some point in time, some of you anyway must have got into a friendship relationship with Catholic civilian girls.
Absolutely. When you were patrolling day and night, you couldn't help but come in contact, especially at night time. Before curfew. In fact, my particular section, I had no problems getting people to patrol the streets from midnight to 2 and 3 in the morning. I couldn't understand why, till I went out to check on them one night and found out they were going down certain streets to meet the girlfriends. And of course, the girls felt safe because they were going out with a soldier, or vice versa. And, so I thought, oh, that's what it's like. And that's what it was like, and I'm sure it was the same in the wars as well.
Now, you'd been promoted, hadn't you, just before
I'd just get my Lance Corporal, yeah.
What's the responsibilities and duties of a Lance Corporal there?
Well, you are the link between the coal face and your senior commanders, your sergeants and your officers. they say, we'll get your men on parade. You go and get your men on parade. You are the one who issues the ammunition out and the stores and everything else. So you are the lower middle management.
And in command of what, 8 men, is that right? The section?
The corporal's in charge of 8, and you, he's 2IC. So you're in charge of the same 8 if he's not there. Or he'll take 4 and you'll take 4 if you're going to split your forces to do a certain operation.
And sometime in the situation you're describing, there must have been quite often moments when you, as a lance corporal, had to make a decision affecting not just your men, but the crowd in front of you.
Oh, everything. That's what it was. Everybody was highly reliant on each other to say, watch your back, go forward, come back, stay there, consolidate, split up. It was very much a very moving object, and everybody's eyes and ears. I mean, the soldiers themselves, you know, every man was looking after each other.
Well, you returned to England. When did you go back to Ireland for your second tour?
Well, just to put it in context, we came back from Ireland. We did retrain and re-roll again to go back to Malaya for another 4 months. This time on a tri-nation, tri-service operation, again on the Vietnam side of life. But this time using the Australians, the New Zealanders and the Malayans, and using the Army, Navy and the Air Force.
Well, we'll make a separate thing of that.
Yeah.
You did that?
Yeah, that was our very next tour. And Northern Ireland then for us didn't happen again until 1971.
Things have changed by now, haven't they?
Yes, the Army's realised this is not going to go away as short and sharp as what we expected, and they started doing Northern Ireland training down at a place called Lydenhithe on the Dover coast.
And what form, what kind of training was that?
Well, we took over an old Army camp and some old Army married quarters, and we turned them into Belfast. And soldiers were then taught IS drills, riot control, how to search houses.
What's IS, by the way?
Internal security. So we were taught right from scratch, from the lessons we'd learned over the previous year, where we were actually being caught out. So you had Northern Ireland training teams, and they were there to learn all the lessons and then partake all them lessons to each battalion that was going to go to Northern Ireland. So they said, right, now the way to do box formation or do patrolling is this way. We now know you get shot at from over there, so you need to do that. And the way to search houses, when you've seen a gunman run in, what they'll do, they'll go in that way and out that way. So the houses are adapted, so you could do mousehole search, you know, so you go into one house, run into the attic, along the attic, and come out another house, because that's what the IRA and other people were doing. They would jump in number one and run along the attics and jump out number five, out the back. So we're taught how to block the streets in, how to block the crowds in, and how to recognise terrorists, and how to recognise this. So it was intensive training after that.
And was it still box training basic?
Not as much as box. It was there because it is a solid way of stopping big areas. And so, but the battle, we found out, was always mobile. It would be a group of people would come in, do what they had to do, and run out. So box forming, you weren't blocking mass crowds anymore. You were chasing people and blocking them off. So you had to learn how to block that street, and this street off, and then go in from this end and hopefully catch them in the middle. So it was a lot of cat and mouse games, but safely, because if you went down the wrong street and the IRA gunmen were in every bedroom of every street, you were stuck down the middle. So it was a case of not getting yourself in a position that you had no means of defence.
So you'd have to read the location pretty well before you...
Yep, I'm afraid street map reading, street maps and everything else had to come as second nature. But on top of that, it was recognising makes and models of cars by colour, by size, a day and night. So if a gunman fired from a car, it's not going to say, no, it was in a car. It had to be, it was a blue car, and we think it was an Orion, and we think, you know, and this, that and the other. And soldiers had to instantly learn. So Kim's game came very, very part of Army training, recognising things so it would flash in your mind and you remember it. Remembering faces in the crowd, what they were wearing, what colour. It came a very recognition-orientated type of warfare.
How did you feel about this, or did you feel that this was soldiering?
No, we thought ourselves as policemen. What were we doing as armed policemen who half the time weren't allowed to shoot? So yes, it was very much very much a policeman in uniform with an army weapon.
And were you taught, obviously, you taught the rules of engagement, if that's the right expression?
Well, rules of engagement were just then coming in where it had to be on paper. So if you're in a riot situation or you're in a shooting situation or a bombing situation, you had to know when you could fire, when you couldn't fire, what you could fire at, who you could fire at. And of course, over the years, that developed and changed year in, year out, due to the intensity of what was... At one time, you couldn't shoot petrol bombers because... You couldn't shoot petrol. Later in life, it was, if he was going to burn your car, Land Rover, or house out, you could. So it changed as life went on to meet the situation. Always under civilian authority, always the police. The army don't make their own rules up because we're always under control of the civilian authorities.
So a pretty intense training, and obviously made the British Army one of the finest... street policemen in the world probably today.
Well, what we used to do, we used to pit battalion against battalion. So in the 71, I think it was a battalion of fusiliers with the IRA and the yobbies on the street. So they would hammer us as hard as they could with bricks, bottle, stones and everything else. And we would go in as for real and do what we did. But later in life that had to stop because too many soldiers were getting injured before they got on the operations. And of course, the ones who were getting the enemy, I mean, they were getting injured, and maybe they were the next battalion to go, so we had to calm down a little bit, but we had to do for real.
Had your equipment and weaponry changed in any way since you last...
Yeah, the tin shields got changed for Macrolon, which was a hardened plastic, clear plastic, used on bank windows, where a gunman couldn't shoot through a bank window. And I think it was one of the first materials that the British Army got without doing a 10-year trial. So we start making the shields of that. And of course, when the bombs and the bullets started and the IEDs, improvised explosive devices, we start putting Macrolon on our Land Rovers as well, at the sides, over the top and underneath, of course, in case there was underground explosions. So that material on Macrolon came in very, very fast. Our shields and everything were made of it. The armour around the Land Rovers was made of it. And of course... Again, things were progressing. People would put piano wire or sharp wire across from lamppost to lamppost. And of course, as you were stood on the tailgate of your Land Rover, you were getting your head chopped off. So that's when we start welding 6-foot pickets to the front of Land Rovers and angling them out. So it would hit the wire first and snap the wire. Then the people commander wouldn't get his head chopped off. But all this was learned. We were just learning every time we went. Anything you combated, they got the next thing. Crowds start to open up, and they would shoot bullets out, and then the crowd would close up, so you couldn't shoot in, because the gunmen had gone. So you had to learn new tactics of how to overcome that.
How do you overcome that?
Well, you couldn't shoot into a crowd, so what you had to do was go aerial, and that's when we had to start taking blocks of flats over. And we would take up the top floor and a sanitised floor underneath, and then we'd stop the lift at that, so nobody could ever come higher than... So it was an 11-storey block of flats. We would take 10 and 11, and civilians living 9 down over.
And that's these were in the sensitive areas, were they?
In the sensitive areas. So we could look down, so we were dominating the ground. And we could see what was happening below us. And that lasted right till this last year or so. So we were learning. Of course, while we were learning... So was the IRA. Of course, bricks and bottles went to bullets and then to bombs, of course. So we had to start learning on our training again how to recognise bombs and what to look for and then disturbances. And of course, when we were finding them, the IRA thought, well, we better bury them in gardens and fields. So then we had to learn to look for a lamppost. And where would you know? So an IRA man would... He would know from that lamppost 20 paces out and 3 in from the hedgerow. So we had to learn them tactics as well. And then the IRA got even better. So he would plough it in, he would bury stuff in autumn and let a farmer plough over the top. And then we couldn't see where the lines were. And then there were other things that we could see from the high towers was funerals. And then we realised, and, oh, wait a minute, Nobody died in that street, so why are they picking a body up in that street? And why are they big? And then we worked out that they were hiding weapons and bombs and ammunition in coffins and burying them. And all this was done by observation posts. And so,
complex, isn't it?
Not what you read
in the papers.
No, and then of course there was a bit of communism in it in the early 70s as well. And then as we started to make friends, or not friends rather, the hearts of mine, so we'd be walking among the populace again. And then of course people start throwing acid bombs. You walk by a crowd of people and next thing you know you're covered in acid. So we were carrying soaking wet blankets and water bottles on us all the time. So if somebody got hit, the buddy-buddy system would come in and you'd throw a blanket over him if he was on fire, or you'd water in to get rid of the acid. And then we realised when the students were doing the, you know, where you get dressed up and you're going around and fireworks and stuff like that, well then the fireworks turned into an explosive. So fireworks were banned in Ireland. And then fancy dressing was, because you couldn't, people would have masks on and you couldn't see, and they would walk up to policemen and they'd be joking and carrying and giving them sweets 1 minute and then shooting them or killing them the next minute. So we had to stop all that kind of thing going on. And then of course all the iron went round the whole of Belfast and we put iron barriers and gates up. And then of course the IRA thought, well, they've got to unlock them gates in the morning and lock them at night, so they booby trap them. So we had to learn how to do it without going, so we had to have observation posts looking at the gates. And it just got messier and dirt. And then of course when you're finding the bombs, they thought, oh well, that's no good. So remote control bombs came in.
Quite sophisticated, aren't they?
And so we had to, combat that by getting ECM, you know, electronic countermeasures.
But, you were going through this training again. When did you leave for Northern Ireland for the second?
That happened in 71, and I did the training, and then I was due to come out of the army, but I bought myself out of the army.
Why'd you done that?
Well, I'd done my 6 year, and I thought, right, it's coming. It was just something was happening, and there was a few of us, Geordies came out. We were getting a little bit disgruntled with the Yorkshire part of it at one stage. And like I told you at the very beginning, it took more years to settle than it took the other battalions. So a few of us came out, and I came out for a short while, met my wife, married her, and then my best friend got killed in Ireland, so I came back in.
That's what brought you back in?
That was one of the main reasons. Jinnah had been killed, a lad from Hartlepool. So I went back to Shrewsbury Depot, retrained. It was meant to be for 6 weeks, but after 6 days, I'd done everything I had to do. They'd given us my Lance Corporal back. So I got on the next ferry to Ireland and joined up with the battalion up in Londonderry this time.
And what date was this?
This was getting to about August. This was August 72 now. And Ty Whitelock, another DLI soldier, had just been shot. So we'd lost Jinnah Rudman, who had been DLI. Sergeant Whitelock, who was the recce platoon sergeant, got shot in Londonderry just before I got there. And Londonderry was a different kettle of fish to Belfast altogether.
And what, where was that?
Well, in a way, that's where all the troubles had started, again, back in 69 with the civil rights marches and all the rest of it. And the man in charge up there, of course, was Martin McGuinness. But again, this was patrols and OPs and going into estates and hiding out overnight and observing. And again, warfare was getting dirtier and dirtier, and we were doing things on the borders where we're putting, again, Ayers and Tobias out, like we used to do in the jungle, to count people crossing the border.
Oh, this is the electronic...
This is the beams, yeah. And at the same time, we were setting up VCPs and covert VCPs.
What are those?
Vehicle checkpoints to see which cars were coming across from the south to the north and north to the south. And we'd be on a place like Bruncana, which is now one of the biggest static VCPs in the whole of Northern Ireland. But we were there, and we'd be lying in hedgerows, and you'd have a poncho over you and a blanket over you to block any light out. And say if it was me, I'd be lying underneath with a torch and a pen and paper, and you'd have two blokes in the hedgerow with a head sticking out, and every car that would come over the bumps, because we put sleeping policemen, first time we've seen sleeping policemen, to slow them down coming past the Three Flowers pub and say, right, it's a green mini vehicle registration, this, this and this, two occupants. It's a red Mercedes, four occupants. And you write all this down and you'd be under this blanket and you just write and write, write, and all you just gathering numbers. Of course, that would go at the vehicle licensing place and that would tell you who the people are. And then you start working out patterns of who was good people and who was terrorists. And this would go backwards and forwards. And these were all mobile VCPs, people hiding in hedgerows and stuff like that. And then, of course, you're going to states and you do it to a Land Rover so cars actually chicane through you. And that was where there's another stopping people and checking people. And without, by then, intelligence was catching up and people could recognise people. And I suppose we had touts as well, sitting in the back of blacked out vehicles saying, he's IRA, he's IRA.
Touts,
we used to call them, or they are called. And so they'd be pointing people out to stop that car because he's in the IRA. And that's how we start making our... Of course, 72, then you had internment, you know, when the real riot started and you had Bloody Sunday and everything else. And all that was up in Londonderry. So it was all escalating at that end of the... at that end of the country.
How long had the battalion been out when you joined them?
They'd been there the first 2 months of the four-month tour.
Yeah.
So we'd done 69 into 70, we'd done 71, and now it was 72.
And they'd obviously... is action the right word? They'd carried out certain things and been... Had they lost anyone? I think they'd lost the sergeant, was it?
Yeah, Ty Whitelaw got shot on that particular tour.
That was that particular tour,
yeah.
Was it?
And then we'd had a guy shot in where the bullet was, he was still stuck in his arm. Things like that were happening. But we'd had our snipers who had killed quite a few people on the borders especially. And we'd had some massive attacks where gunmen were coming across from the border and we were shooting, oh, you better stop that.
What was your personal experiences of the border activities?
Well, we used to get called out. We were a support company, so we'd go in support of the rifle companies who'd sometimes made contact with gunmen over cross-border shooting, and we would go out and resupply the ammunition, the shamoolies, the machine gun belts for the GPMGs, and anything else they'd expended. So we would literally go out and support them, and if necessary, take part in the cross-border shoots. But if it was a rifle company patch, it was up to them to sort out their shooting areas.
Did you personally get involved in any firing, shooting?
Me personally, never fired a shot in anger on these first lorry tours. If you think the battalion was spread over quite a large area in Londonderry, I mean, we... a support company were in Fort George, but you had the rifle companies down in the Rosemount, the Craigan, Bly's Lane and the Bogside, right up to the middle of June or the end of June when the pirates said they would have a ceasefire. But of course, they never really did. It was all in words. And of course, shootings were happening from Sangers every single day and every night especially. And at some stages, the fighting was so intense that we used to use the old donkey's ears for looking over the top of the Sangers.
What's the donkey's ears?
Like you used to in the World War One trenches.
The periscopes?
The periscopes, yeah. Because you had to look out the trenches through out of the Sangers through them before you dare lift your head up, especially when you were changing sentries. And that happened on a regular basis, especially in Bly's Lane.
And this has been pretty intense then, this fighting.
Oh, yeah, right up to June and July. I mean, it was on the 31st of July that the battalion took part in Operation Karakara, or Karakan, where they had to take down the barricades down in the Craigan and the Bogside because IRA controlled the area and it was a no-go area. And it went from Londonderry to Derry. And you've seen the famous signs, you are now entering free Derry. And soldiers and police couldn't get in them areas.
You mentioned Sangers that the companies were dug into or would have built up in. Where were these in relation to the... was this out in the countryside?
No, the VCPs were out in the countryside, the Brunkana and the Muff VCPs, and that was stopping cross-border vehicle checkpoints coming in. No, these were in the estates of the Bogside and the Craigan and you know, down by the Foyle River, and there were built up sanghas, built onto buildings, and we used to change sentries in the back of armoured vehicles. And it was a case of out the back of the vehicle, and you dive out and get into your sangha, and the sangha man would dive out and get into the Saracen or whatever we're using.
So presumably the sanghas were built right in the centre of all this IRA activity.
Oh yeah,
surrounded by it in effect.
Absolutely. I mean, built into police stations, factory complexes, whichever buildings we were taking over to observe and take the high ground, if you want.
And I think you said you'd suffered casualties by this time.
Yeah, there was, I forget the name of the young lad, who got shot on the racecourse road. In fact, the Armalite bullet was still stuck in the back of his arm when we took some famous photographs. But there wasn't many patrols could actually go out without coming under one kind of enemy fire or a blast bomb or something.